You are now listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast, where the worlds of sports medicine and performance collide. My name is Mike Quintons. I'm a physical therapist with an entrepreneurial mindset that specializes in treating orthopedic and sports injuries. I'm bringing on the brightest and sharpest in the field of sports medicine to share their best practices and explore the gap where medicine meets performance. What's happening, Performance Therapy Nation? This is Mike Quintons, your host of the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast. Today, we are joined by two physical therapists that are pelvic floor specialists, Dr. Lara Hamad Kisumbing and Dr. Emily Titus. Today, we will learn who is at risk for pelvic floor conditions and how it's diagnosed and treated. But before we get into this discussion, I would like to thank our listeners, you guys listening right now. Thank you for tuning in. The feedback on our website, onqueperformancetherapy.com, and the reviews have been fantastic. The feedback we get from our listeners drives my passion to continue to reach out to professionals like the two we have here today and broadcast their expertise and inspire thought for our audience. With that said, I do have a 30-second request. When this is over, pull up the page this is playing on. Tap the three little dots lined up at the bottom right corner part of the screen. Tap go to show, then scroll down to the bottom, add a review off by offering your thoughts and requests. If there's any specialists you want to listen to, by all means, please list them or a specialty and we'll get them on. All right, so let's get into it. Dr. Lara Hamad Kisumbing is a doctorate of physical therapy and is currently the clinic director of Excel Physical Therapy in Villanova. She graduated from Drexel University, PT, class of 2012, and has been with Excel Physical Therapy since graduating. She became an ACD in 2018, then a clinic director last year in 2021. In 2016, she went through the Evidence in Motions certification program for pelvic health and has been treating that population ever since. And we also have Emily Titus. Emily Titus is a doctor of physical therapy and practices orthopedic and pelvic floor physical therapy with Ivy Rehab at the Physical Therapy and Wellness Institute in Lansdale, PA. She has been practicing physical therapy for 4 years in orthopedics, but in the past year found her passion for pelvic health. She loves how the two fields blend together and finds a lot of people with pelvic dysfunction who get overlooked and underdiagnosed, often presenting with orthopedic symptoms and missing the treatment that they need to get better. Emily received her Bachelor's of Science in Kinesiology from James Madison University, then obtained her doctorate in physical therapy from Newman University. She's currently in an orthopedic clinical specialist residency program with Ivy Rehab and the Hospital for Special Surgery and Science, so HSS, for her OCS, Orthopedic Certified Specialist exam next March. Thanks for getting on, guys. I appreciate it. So connections real quick. Lara and I used to work at Excel Physical Therapy. Mm-hmm. I spent, unfortunately for Lara, 200 hours shadowing.
We had fun.
Val Brill's getting a shout out on the podcast for my residency and my OCS. And what an awesome clinic. You were there. Johnson was there. Russ was also there at the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was very fortunate to have spent 200 hours. I don't know about you guys, but 200 hours with you guys there. That was an awesome experience. And Emily and I met you on like LinkedIn, and then you had applied for a position.
Right.
And then linked you up with Lansdale. And
because I knew you through Nick Barbieri.
That's right. Yeah.
And then he linked us up, and now I'm here.
And I try to avoid saying his name on the podcast, but yeah, there it is. So, no, Nick's my guy. I got to give him some crap. So you've now been there for how long? How long have you been alive?
I've been there since June.
Okay.
Last year.
Cool. And I think it's also important to note that the Physical Therapy and Wellness Institute and Excel Physical Therapy are owned by Ivy Rehab. So technically we're all teammates. Yep. All right, let's get into this, guys. So let's start with the basics. And I really don't know much about this. Lara, I know, has been doing this for a while now. So I would love to get your guys' take on this on a lot of different topics. So I'm in the dark. If I speak incorrectly, let me know. What is the pelvic floor? Lara, go for it.
Okay. The pelvic floor is a collection of muscles that sits inside the pelvis. Sitting above it would be your organs. So your bladder, your uterus for women, your rectum is in there. So the muscles help to support. They help with sexual function. They help with urination, bowel movements, all that kind of stuff.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. And the certification process, Emily, how does one get certified in treating pelvic health? And I know you've gone through this process in Evidence in Motion, so I'm curious about both your experiences and going through that and gaining more experience in treating it.
I mean, from what I understand, there's multiple avenues through which to obtain certification and specialization through it. So there's Herman and Wallace Pelvic Institute, and then the APTA has their own little like pathway for it. But it's just a series, a collection of different educational continuing ed courses that you take that kind of build off of each other. And then ultimately there is an examination that you need to pass to actually become like a full-blown board certified or a recognition for a specialist.
Awesome. Do you have anything to add to that, Lara?
Nope, that was right.
Is there a national, like for the OCS, right? Like whether you're in California or PA, there's a board exam for it. Is there a board specialization exam for this as well? That's like universal?
There's two. Like yeah. So from what I've learned, it's that there's the PRPC certification. It's like a pelvic rehabilitation practitioner certification through Herman and Wallace. And then there's the APTA has their women's health specialist. So that's gotcha. Like comparable with the OCS because it's all through APTA. But then right. Herman and Wallace also has their PRPC that's kind of on the same playing field. But the APTA one also encompasses like women's health in terms of oncologic care, lymphedema, different like pre, postpartum, antepartum, like anything with pregnancy. Whereas the Herman and Wallace is more just, it doesn't do anything with lymphedema or cancer treatment.
Gotcha. And just so our listeners know, the APTA is the American Physical Therapy Association, which is, you know, that's our universe. Like everyone knows the APTA and they're the ones who grant us specializations and so forth. All right. What are some of the common ways someone develops a condition of the pelvic floor? Go ahead, Em.
I mean, it can happen through no real reason at all. It can also happen through like a clear cut. Like I've seen people with like a trauma from a car accident or they fell and broke their tailbone, things like that. But sometimes it's just like you pull a muscle. Sometimes you can pull an internal muscle on your pelvic floor and then the pain might present in the pelvic region, but it also could be referred elsewhere. And that's, I think, where a lot of people kind of get overlooked.
Yeah, now, and that, I think that's probably going to be one of the biggest takeaways is what can PTs look for? What can, you know, the average person look for in their, you know, in their symptom presentation that would maybe guide them towards seeing, you know, a pelvic health specialist? So pregnancy, obviously very common. Larry, dive in a little bit of that. So what about a pregnancy puts strain on the pelvic floor muscles?
Yeah, so as a woman gains weight during pregnancy, that's just a lot more pressure on those muscles down there. For some people, it doesn't affect them at all, but for a lot of people, it does. And then depending on how they then deliver, can really just, who knows what will happen after that.
Gotcha, right. So there can be tearing of some of those yeah. muscles. There can be overstretching of
tearing,
those muscles.
The patient afterwards can either have really weak muscles after delivery or on the opposite side can have really tight muscles. Those muscles just kind of clam up. After delivery, and then that person would have a lot of pain.
All right, I'll stick with you on this. Who typically diagnoses that the condition?
I mean, if it's a postpartum woman, usually they're OBGYN. Sometimes if it's a pain that's not specifically pelvic, then an orthopedic physician can do that as well.
Gotcha. In your experience, Emily, like, do you find, how often are you the one who's identifying the diagnosis?
I wouldn't say that I ever like solely will diagnose. I'll suggest because I can't really truly confirm or deny a diagnosis, but I'll suggest that like perhaps this is pelvic in nature where I find that there's a good handful of patients that have pain, go to their primary care physician. They say it seems like a pelvic problem, go see an OBGYN. So then they wait another few weeks to see an OBGYN. The OBGYN says, I don't really know, go see a urogynecologist. It sounds like it could be something
bladder
related.
Yeah.
It could be something that it's out of an OBGYN spectrum of care. So then I feel like they then get sent to a pelvic therapist. And then typically there's a big wait to see a pelvic therapist because it's such a niche practice that it ends up being a span of months or weeks that somebody's kind of bouncing around. And then once you see a pelvic specialist, it's something where if it's a muscle spasm, it's pretty clear cut when you push on the muscle and it produces your pain. That's going to be the diagnosis. Or if it's something where you have no strength and you can't isolate a muscle contraction, then that's likely going to be the problem that you're coming in with. But I feel like a lot of the physicians will kind of look for something less muscle related, which is nobody's fault. I think it's just a difference in the education that we receive as physical therapists versus physicians.
Okay. I think that that's a great explanation. Lara, what you've been doing this for a few years now, and I can say personally that I know you've, you know, we work 10 minutes away from each other for a while now. You've developed a reputation to treat, you know, these conditions. So patients come to you, I would imagine now, sometimes with like direct access, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which means without a physician's referral. So in those situations, typically we are proposing, you know, some type of, you know, condition or diagnosis or pathology. Tell me your experience with, you know, diagnosing or, you know, identifying a potential pathology.
Yeah. So, I mean, just depending on what their symptoms are, that can usually give you a pretty good idea of what's going on. And then an internal exam, which is just one finger for women through the vagina, for men through the rectum, can just give you a really good idea of what's going on.
And what are you doing? And so you're palpating, muscle tone, tension. Tell me what else you're looking for.
So feeling the muscle quality. So if there's tightness, muscle spasms, sometimes if we're talking orthopedic injuries or not pelvic conditions, if you touch on an internal muscle, that could recreate their back pain or their glute pain or their hamstring pain. And then also internally, you can test their strength. So have them do a Kegel, which is a pelvic floor contraction. And you can see, are they doing it properly? Are they not doing it at all, even though they think they're doing it? And then you can teach them how to do that properly.
Awesome.
That's pretty cool.
That's perfect. No, thank you. So who's at risk? What patients are at risk for this condition? Obviously, pregnancy. Are there any other patient populations that you would think, okay, we got to make sure we're screening for this or we're at least asking some of the right questions?
I guess as you age, you could be at risk. Not necessarily, but you know, you always hear, oh, as you get older, I leak a little bit when I cough, sneeze, laugh, things like that, which a lot of people think is normal. It is not normal. It doesn't have to be normal. So sometimes just going through history, they're like, oh, I have that, but it's fine because I'm 60 or whatever.
I've had three kids. Of course, I'm going to leak.
Yeah.
I'll say that again to yourself.
Yeah.
That's not normal.
Interesting. Yeah, no, that I feel like that's common.
Very common.
I feel like we've all had patients. I can speak for the other PTs that work in the Newtown Square office. We've all had patients that have like, oh yeah, like sometimes it happens, but, or they like, they minimize it. Does that sound fair?
Yeah, or like, oh, don't make me laugh so hard, Q. I might pee myself. Right. And it's like, or if they use the restroom four times in an hour long session and it's like, okay, maybe we should have a conversation about this because that's not normal.
Interesting. All right. That's a good sign to look for. Like if they're running to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. All right. Have you noticed an increase in demand for treatment of pelvic floor pathology? And if so, why? Go ahead, Emily.
I mean, I don't know that I can necessarily speak to it since I only started practicing a few months ago. So in my practice, I've noticed a demand for it solely because I think I've been pretty vocal about it out in the community with primary care physicians. Because a lot of times, just like you're saying, like primary cares will see on an intake that somebody checks incontinence, you know, 7 times out of 10 when they have a patient throughout the day. Like, so many people have incontinence. So I'm trying to be pretty vocal about it. So in my practice, I've seen it, but I think generally speaking, kind of the general public is getting to be more aware of it. Before we started recording, we were kind of joking about TikTok has a whole pelvic floor following about people are becoming aware of like, oh my God, this is not normal. Or like I've seen videos on Facebook of somebody deadlifting and hitting their PR and peeing all over the floor. And people are like, oh my God, yeah. And I'm like, no, that's A, disgusting, and B, not normal. Like, what are you doing? You shouldn't be doing that. So I think people are kind of understanding that things that once were considered normal are not. And I think that's kind of gaining traction.
Yeah. What do you think, Lara?
Yeah. I mean, that was a really good answer. Me personally, I haven't really seen an increase, but I mean, I've gotten to know a lot of the referral sources. So I guess they are sending me more people just because they know me. But other than that,
do you think referral sources are more aware? Do you feel like, do you feel like you spend time and you're a CD? So a CD is a clinic director, at Excel, they are responsible for marketing, right? So, you know, clinic director would be responsible for educating, our referral sources on what we do and how we do it. So, is that something you feel like you have spent time on or should, or what are your thoughts on that?
Probably more should. Just with COVID, you're not really getting That's much face-to-face fair. Time with those physicians. But just when I have a patient that I hear and they're like, well, I told my doctor I was having this problem and they just told me to wait. But then I still kept having the problem. So that makes me want to go and try to spread the word a little bit more.
Or the worst is when they say, my doctor said it's normal.
That's wild. I feel like I've like learned about the like the frequency or the prevalence of it, right? I feel like it's much more, I'm more aware of the prevalence of it. I also feel like you probably get a lot of patients that don't have a pelvic floor dysfunction and they were diagnosed with it or told that they had it and they saw you. I remember there's one patient in particular, I'm like, I think it's something with that. And I sent her over to you and you're like, no, it's not that. Oh. So, but nonetheless, I hope that we're becoming more aware and we're educating, especially other medical professionals who are seeing these patients first, right? Okay. And that way we can get them the help that they need efficiently and quickly. Is there imaging? So how would a physician diagnose? Are they also doing an internal examination? And is that the primary way of diagnosing it? Lara, you can take that one.
Yeah, we don't really see that much imaging. I mean, unless it's somebody that has a diagnosis of like an endometriosis or an adenomyosis, they're probably doing more ultrasound type stuff. But no, I mean, really it's more their symptoms, more just their physical, what the muscles look like, that kind of a thing.
Emily, what are some symptoms one could expect? I know we already touched on a couple of them, but like, let's kind of run through like a list if we can. So it's important for, you know, people listening, they know somebody or they themselves.
I mean, my biggest thing when I'm treating ortho, like I'm constantly screening for it because it's so prevalent that a lot of people don't recognize that they have a problem. So a lot of times if somebody has some sort of a, like a back pain issue or a hip issue or things like that, I'll ask about, oh, do you have any episodes where if you laugh too hard, will you leak? Or do you have painful intercourse or insertion? Like, can you tolerate tampons or a speculum? Because some people don't necessarily have penetrative intercourse. So some people never have any sort of penetration. So they might think that, oh, well, sex for me is fine, but no, I could never use tampons. So that's kind of like a something that in my early practice, I was like, oh my God, I didn't even consider that. But that's right. A big thing to consider.
Sure.
So symptoms of like painful intercourse and or painful insertion and then leaking at all. Like sometimes people will say, I'll laugh and I'll leak. Or some people will say when I squat down to pick something out of the bottom aisle at a grocery store, I'll leak. Or it's not even necessarily sometimes about leaking. Sometimes it's that as soon as they're hit with the urge that they have to pee, suddenly it's like, I have to drop what I'm doing or I will pee myself. So the urge kind of hitting them really, really quickly and overwhelming, as well as leaking with activity or leaking for no apparent reason. Sometimes people will say, yeah, I feel like I just have this like fullness in my pelvis where they might be retaining urine or they might have an organ that's prolapsing, which is all something that we can work on. Some people think, oh, I've had 3 kids like, and they were all vaginal deliveries and then I'm just going to have my uterus fall out. It's like, no, like again, say that again to yourself. That's not normal. I mean, it's certainly something that's typical, unfortunately, with women just because of the trauma of childbirth, but it's not something that people have to live with necessarily. It's not something that should be normal.
Yeah, go ahead, Larry. You have anything to add to that?
In terms of symptoms?
Yeah.
So anybody that has constipation issues too could fall into that category. You had mentioned earlier the frequency. So if they feel like they have to pee every hour, even more frequent than that. People that wake up in the middle of the night to pee, sometimes that can be normal, but if it's excessive, then
gotcha.
Probably indicates something's going on.
So the pelvic floor is considered a core muscle. How is that similar or different to like the core muscle injury that we see in like sports hernias, mm-hmm. right? So like your adductor tendon, is there any relation between the two? I believe they cross paths, but you guys know the anatomy better than I do.
Yeah, well, they both connect to the bony pelvis itself.
Right, gotcha. Mm-hmm. And just from different angles, right? Yep. I would imagine. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think a lot of the fascial connections are pretty big too.
Interesting. Yeah. And
there's a lot of different studies coming out with fascial connections throughout the core and pelvic floor that go into the lower extremities as well. I can't really speak to them. I just know that there's a lot of work being done on those. I've seen little bits and pieces, but I didn't have time to read on them.
And would that tap into like, and again, like, I don't know much about this, but I know about soft tissue release and myofascial release and active release techniques, et cetera. Would that tap into that? Like for an internal examination, if you're doing a soft tissue release, are you like essentially like a myofascial release type thing? Does that sound right?
You mean
like, can you do a myofascial release internally?
Oh yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. This is, I'm learning a lot. All right. So what techniques do you use to treat pelvic floor conditions? I know you mentioned it, like strengthening and internal examination. Let's get into treatment a little bit. What type of techniques would you use, Lara?
So if it is more on the pain side and the muscles are tight, we want to do a lot of soft tissue work. So either that's internally with a finger. So that's something I would do with the patient in the clinic. And then teaching them how to do that at home. So either a partner would do that with them, or there's different devices you could buy, like a pelvic wand, that could do a trigger point release on your own. There's also something called dilators that do like a general stretch to those muscles. So that person would need more soft tissue work and stretching.
And they would that person also have referral, like referred pain elsewhere at times, or could not always, but
yeah,
could.
Sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then you mentioned, so that would be the soft tissue release, the flexibility, mobility component of it.
Correct.
How about the stability or stabilization component of it? You want to touch on that?
Yeah. I mean, the basic premise of it is Kegel training. But some people cannot isolate a Kegel contraction, for whatever reason. Some people have said they've had a stroke or that they've had like a TIA, like a mini stroke. Some people kind of dissociate mentally from that area if they've had some sort of a trauma, if they've experienced a sexual trauma. Other people just like never think about their pelvic region. And so they just, when I say, okay, try to squeeze around my finger, they're like, I am, and I'm not feeling anything. So in those cases, you would try to use, like I've tried to use stim. It's not very pleasant necessarily, but it's something that can help to elicit the contraction. Or there is a whole myriad of different cues you can use to try to engage the pelvic floor, or different techniques you can use. But in terms of like a strength stability, I try to not just isolate the pelvic muscles. I try to use some of the other, like the hip rotational muscles, because a couple of the rotational muscles of the hip are also considered pelvic floor muscles. So trying to kind of engage everything, like your TA, like that sort of thing, even using your adductors sometimes, you'll try to kind of help to co-contract and engage things for a better contraction. So that's more or less what you're going to do to stabilize that region.
So a core exercise that I've done in the past would be, and I'm kind of tying it into what you just said there, would be implementing a ball between the knees and a squeeze, like an adductor squeeze, right? And then a pelvic tilt or a different type of mobility. I've even done it in like standing and bending forward, and it's amazing, like people feel better when they do that. So curious, are you like tying that in with like a Kegel? Does that sound right?
Yeah, I always explain on the evaluation that as much as I'd like to hang out in a private room for an hour doing internal work, both of us don't want to. And I don't care if you can hold a 3-minute Kegel. If you still pick up your infant from the crib and have pain or leak, that's what you're here for. So I try to isolate the contraction initially in the room and kind of get it down and then translate it into more functional activity. So it might start with just like a TA brace with a Kegel, or like a bridge with a adduction with a ball between your knees and a Kegel, and then trying to work on standing with it and trying to maintain a Kegel with it, or reaching or squatting or deadlifting with a Kegel.
So how do we know... Is it fair to assume that if they were able to perform a Kegel like in the room, that they're actually performing the Kegel when they're fatigued, right?
Right.
Like, and we deal with, I deal with the same thing orthopedically. I know you guys obviously both treat orthopedics as well, but I'm like, all right, are you actually getting the glutes like the fire now? Like, will BJ Smith reference, like, is the glute medius actually turning on, or are you just cheating and doing that exercise and using your
really good at compensating?
You know, yeah, your TFL or something like right. that. Yeah, let's backtrack it. For like two hot seconds. What is a Kegel? Go ahead, Lara.
A Kegel is a pelvic floor contraction. So that muscle group that sits in the pelvis, it contracts by squeezing and by lifting. So the lifting is what supports all of those organs, and the squeezing is what would stop your flow of urine.
So when would the average person utilize those muscles? You mentioned it stop, like,
yeah,
like if I really got to go and yep, like I'm holding it.
Standing in line at the grocery store and you have to pee, those muscles are kicking in, so you just don't pee yourself.
So they're voluntary, obviously, but are they ever involuntary?
I think you could argue that they're both.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. Like, I think, like, there's a whole premise of doing the knack, which is a technique, I don't know why it's called the knack, but where people, if they sneeze or cough and they leak, trying to tell them, okay, if you feel a sneeze coming on, most of us aren't just, like, struck down by a sneeze. You can kind of feel it coming on. When you feel it coming on, contract your pelvic floor so that you kind of like teach your body and brain to then do a pelvic floor contraction before you have a stress to your core. So I think like we can teach it volitionally, but I think, I don't know, that's a really kind of a, it's not like it's a smooth muscle. It's not truly involuntary, right, but it's something that I think a lot of people just kind of do.
Yeah. You shouldn't have to think about it. As right. when you were growing up, you didn't have right. to think, oh, my mom's calling my name, let me stop my pee. So, you know, it just happened, right?
Right.
But now, just through life changes, stress, whatever the case, any dysfunction, you kind of do have to think about it if you're trying to relearn how to do it.
Right. That's what makes it a dysfunction.
What is most common in terms of like flexibility or stability? Like what is one more common than the other in terms of what you're focusing on? Like that this individual needs to work on more flexibility, mobility versus stabilization, they need to get stronger? Or is it always a little bit of both?
Good question. I would say it's not one or the other. I mean, not one is more prevalent than the other. Not always do they need both, but sometimes. Everybody's
that's
different.
All right, that's fair. No, and I'm trying to apply a lot of these concepts because we're still dealing with muscles, right? Mm-hmm. And even with loading muscles, right? Like, so yeah. So I'm trying to apply it to ortho and how I, you know, see things. And it essentially, like it, to an extent it is, just a very localized area. How do we increase the resistance or volume that a muscle work, that a muscle can do over the course of a session, right? Like I would want to do, making this up, like 6 to 8 sets of like glute functional movements and as well as like 3 to 4 sets of like activation exercises before, you know, I do an exercise that incorporates a functional movement with the glute medius. Like I want to activate it and then mm-hmm. do the functional component. So how do I increase resistance or volume, right? You can do it through duration. You can do it through sets. You can do it through reps. You do through resistance, right? So how do you do that with this muscle group?
I usually start with different positions. So laying supine, which is flat on your back, is the easiest way. Gravity is not affecting you. You can really feel what you're doing. And then session to session, depending on how they're doing, I'll change the position. So next, you know, maybe on all fours is another way to do it. Then we can progress to standing. And then eventually we're adding some weight. We're adding some bands for resistance, things like that.
And the weights and bands are like around the ankles or knees. Or
yeah, like any other orthopedic exercise, but you're doing that pelvic floor contraction, that Kegel. Yep. I coach a lot about breathing, right? That kind of thing.
So, all right, yep. Cool. Tell me how breathing is involved with it.
It's my favorite thing.
Please, no, because that's something I'm currently learning more about. So yeah, tell me more.
I get a little crazy with the breathing. People don't want to hear me say it. So our bodies are pressure systems, okay? So if there's too much pressure in your body and you have a dysfunction in your pelvic floor, you're going to leak, right? Something's going to happen. So I teach a lot of my patients to exhale while they're doing a contraction so that the pressure exits from their mouth rather than from putting pressure down below.
Gotcha. All right. So sequencing the breathing with mm-hmm. contractions during sets and reps.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
If you're holding your breath, wrong. Get out of here.
And I'm sure that would be one of the things you would be looking for when they're trying to activate, like you said earlier, Emily, like, so if they're contracting or they think they're contracting, you're feeling nothing. That would be a cue then, right? Like
focus. So many people hold their breath. And then I always go into how like the diaphragm and pelvic floor kind of work as like a partnership sort of. So when you take a deep breath and use your diaphragm to inhale, your diaphragm descends in your abdomen and it passively stretches downward your pelvic floor. So sometimes if somebody has a restriction, I'll just start with diaphragmatic breathing because it's easy, well, easier than other options. And it can passively stretch that area because a lot of times trying to stretch that area because it's such a deep group of muscles is pretty tough. So trying to learn how, because I'll tell people like, okay, try and do a Kegel. And then they kind of like do this funky brace thing and they start turning red. And I'm like, okay, that's not it. We first have to talk about breathing because anything that you're going to be doing, even if you get down the Kegel, if as soon as you try to do a muscle contraction, you hold your breath and so much that I can start seeing you turn red, we have to focus on that first and then figure out how to isolate it.
I love that. That's a great explanation. We're talking about breathing. It's a slight pivot to like athletes. Is it common to see an athlete suffering from a pelvic floor dysfunction? And if so, how? Why? Go there.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's much more common than an average person. Let's see.
Are there any sports in particular that stick out?
Not necessarily. I see a lot of runners, maybe because it's a lot of the pounding on the ground.
And gymnasts. A lot of like that downward like boom at the finish. Same thing from runners.
Interesting.
And they're usually very hypermobile and flexible.
Gotcha. So. Interesting. So stability would be their deficiency with something like this. Interesting. Does treatment change at all for an athlete? Like, would you condition an athlete differently or treat an athlete differently than you would, you know, the 65-year-old grandmom who just realized that she's had pelvic floor condition over the last like 20 years?
I mean, the basics are the same, right? Doing that proper pelvic floor contraction with the breathing pattern. But I guess then they're higher level. They want to get back to more resisted jumping, that kind of thing. Whereas the 80-year-old probably doesn't want to. So you just have to train them with a higher load.
Gotcha. So yeah, go ahead, Emily. Got anything to add to that?
Well, I was just going to say that sometimes with comparing the 65-year-old that has had it for 20 years versus an 18-year-old who suddenly started having leaking or pain with their sport, I think a big part of it too, just like in orthopedics, you want to find the driver for that issue. Is it that they've always just had restriction? Is it that they have restriction because of some undealt with trauma that was before? Is it because they were practicing a vault off of a beam and they came down the wrong way and kind of caught their leg funky, or like what caused it? And then if they really want to get back into that sport, then trying to, like Lara said, trying to translate it into as similar to the sport that it is. Because like you said earlier, I don't know if you're doing a Kegel when you're doing, you know, some higher level sport thing. So trying to really hit it hard home that like, okay, everything that we're going to be doing in the clinic, you have to kind of, some of it's awareness of, okay, can you feel when you lose a Kegel contraction? Up until if they can't tell me, oh, I think I'm losing it, then I can't really progress and do more functional stuff because your guess is as good as mine. I don't know if you're holding it or not. So trying to kind of see if they can isolate and recognize when they lose it, and then trying to apply it to as high level as within possible in your clinic.
Gotcha. So I think I feel like I go back to positions, right? Like if they're doing something overhead and there's resistance overhead, or if they're holding themselves up, or if they're in a squatted position a lot, right? Like you want to functionally train them, you know, to do a Kegel or activate their pelvic floor muscles while they're in that position. So treatment doesn't change a ton. It just, the load changes. So postpartum women returning to sport, are there any considerations that we, you know, as PTs, or even for them, should have?
Well, it all depends. Are they leaking? Are they having pain? Are they having both? So just doing an assessment and evaluating and see, do they have weakness? Do they have tightness? And then going from there.
How much pain, if any, is normal?
None.
Right. So, So healing. So had a, you know, you had your baby, you know, 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know, there's it depends on tearing, right, significance, and all that.
Okay, no, I changed
that,
my right? answer.
no, but yeah, I think it all depends on, right. You're talking like 6 months or even 3 months or 1 month. Even.
Yeah. So you don't want pain further out, but you know, 12 weeks, you know, I think an OBGYN would give you clearance to return to sport or whatever it is at 6 weeks. I personally think that's too early because things are healing. I mean, you just had this 10-pound thing pass through your canal. So I would prefer people wait till 12 weeks, if not a little bit longer. You just really want your body, number one, to heal itself. And then if they're still having issues, things that we can address.
Along those lines, can we, Emily, if you don't mind touching on like a progression, appropriate progression, like I can speak about my wife, right? So we have a 16-month-old. She's a marathon runner. She can't just like 6 weeks, doc clears her to get back to sport.
The magical 6 weeks.
Right. And so she can't just like go run, right? Like she can, but it may not end up too well. So I want your take on how should, like, what is the appropriate progression at 6, 8, 10 weeks, whatever you, whenever you get clearance to return to running?
Okay. I mean, generally speaking, like everyone's going to be individual. Some people might have minimal pain, minimal leaking, and feel fine with minimal damage. Some people bounce right back from it, and other people have a really tough time. But generally speaking, when I have somebody postpartum who wants to get back into a higher level sport or even like a higher impact sport, I have them be able to do pain-free full contraction and full relaxation of their pelvic floor in supine, so laying on their back. Then I get them on all fours. Then I get them to do it standing. And then generally speaking, once those things are pain-free and not having any issue, I try to then transition into body weight exercises. So like squats with a Kegel and making sure that you're maintaining it and that you're able to fully relax when you need to. Because sometimes people just hold a pelvic floor contraction and to the point where it becomes a further restriction. So being able to relax is a whole part of it as well. So then transitioning to body weight, then adding resistance and weight, and then kind of going to an elliptical and then doing kind of easing your way into interval training with jogging. That's just what I've done in my experience with my education, but Lara might have other thoughts.
I mean, that sounded really good. I usually, unfortunately, see people after they have already started running and then are having a lot of problems. So
I think that's fair. I would imagine, and it's interesting, I asked about a progression to running and you started with supine, right? And that's a great answer. And we do that in other, you have an ACL tear, you're going to start supine quad sets and progress from there. So that makes perfect sense. So you would start in a supine position, progress to functional movements, and go to walking,
correct.
The elliptical and so forth. And then even interval training, it's now you can jog a mile. Now, you can jog, 100
jog
yards
the straights,
and then
walk the curves, right, that exactly. sort of thing. Yeah. Cause I think a lot of people think, oh, well, we're women, we're designed to have kids, this is a beautiful thing. And all of that is completely true, but it's still a trauma to your body. Just like if you were to go get your ACL repaired, or if you, tear your labrum, it's still a trauma to your body. And a lot of people have a lot of, tearing, or if their baby comes out breech, or if they get stuck in the canal, whatever, there's all sorts of different ways to have a trauma during your birth. And some people have mental trauma afterwards from it, and other components to it other than the physical trauma. So it's something to remember that it's a beautiful thing and it's part of life and it's what female bodies are more or less designed for, but it's still a huge undertaking to go through. And you can't kind of downplay that, because people are like, oh, 6 weeks, my doctor said I can run, why can't I run? I'm like, well, you pushed a thing out of you and you tore and you were sutured and and that was your third one. Right.
Well said. And you mentioned, some of the psychological, issues that an individual may be dealing with. I think it's also important to mention, that's what we have to deal with orthopedic injuries too.
Correct.
So we have to be able to implement a multidisciplinary approach where, someone else needs to get involved, a psychologist of some kind. I think it's important to recognize that may, that applies to this as well, just like other
right.
conditions.
It's got to be a team approach.
What can sports organizations do to reduce the prevalence of pelvic floor conditions in their athletes? This is a deep philosophical question, but I feel like awareness is everything. That's part of the reason of this podcast. So what can we do as medical professionals to help these organizations, be more aware or screen? I don't know. What are some of your guys' thoughts on that? Go ahead, Em. You can go first.
I mean, you said, awareness is key. That's the hill that I'm going to die on, is awareness, because so many people, I've had people come in with an incontinence script. I don't know why I'm here. I'm not incontinent. Do you leak when you laugh or cough? Oh God, don't even get me started. I was out with the girls the other night and it was awful. And I'm like, well, that's incontinence. I think some people have this idea that incontinence is what you think about when you think about old people homes of people just sitting in their urine all day. It's well, some people lose complete control. You're right. But leaking at all is still incontinence. It's still loss of voluntary control of your bowel and bladder. So I think trying to teach people that even if you're hitting that deadlift PR and you feel like you're leaking, that's not normal. And then trying to also, I've had people the same thing, oh, I didn't realize that intercourse was supposed to be after I had a kid, I thought it was just going to hurt. I had a kid come through there. How is it going to ever feel normal again? And I'm like, well, it shouldn't hurt. I can tell you that.
Right.
where just identifying that insertion should not hurt. And then if you're leaking, it's not considered normal. If you're having pain in a region that you've never had pain before, I think too, a lot of people are kind of shy to speak up about, well, when I have vaginal intercourse, it hurts, because you have to say vagina or you have to admit that to a physician who's standing in front of you, and you might not really see them often, and you get 5 minutes of FaceTime with them every year. And then you have to tell them I'm leaking, and it might be embarrassing to bring it up, where I think it's just an awareness of it happens, and it's something that doesn't need to happen.
I think you could say the same for the same situation, athletes saying that to their coach.
Right, exactly. Right?
Or, you know, like
if an athlete gets a physical for their sport, or they get their check-in with their physician, and it's usually somebody who they're just kind of like palling around with, hey doc, yeah, I'm feeling great. My hamstring strain, it's much better. And by the way, I'm leaking. Like I feel like some people might find it kind of embarrassed about bringing it up when it's something that absolutely should be addressed.
Great response. Larry, you got anything to add to that?
I mean, I think on that end, also, a coach probably wouldn't know where to go with that either.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, just education. Yeah,
right. I mean, is an adequate screening enough to increase awareness?
I mean, I guess just asking questions, right?
And like the right questions.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Understanding that. Are they actually understanding what I'm asking in this question?
Yeah. Like my big thing, I think people think, like I said, of incontinence as being like sitting in a puddle of your own urine. Where if you leak when you laugh, or if you leak when you squat, or if you leak when you jump, that's incontinence. So like if asking instead of, do you experience incontinence, instead of asking that, do you leak? Do you ever leak urine without meaning to? Or do you have painful insertion vaginally or rectally or whatever? That sort of thing.
So this goes back to like mitigating the risk of this condition or being aware of it, right? So we talked about diagnosing, talked about treatment, talked about like screenings that we can do with athletes. What can we do to prevent this from happening, right? Like prevents, not the right word, but mitigate the risk of this, you know, diagnosis. What are your thoughts on that, Lara?
That's tough. I guess if we're talking pregnancy, postpartum, I mean, I do see pregnant women who maybe have some, you know, pelvic laxity, things like that. So just educating them on how to, like, different birthing positions and things like that, so that to reduce their other possible risk of what they might experience postpartum. But they usually end up seeing me because they're already having some sort of pain or discomfort.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I think it's important to incorporate that into your treatment, right? Like you know, if they're at risk for it, you know, given their circumstances, then that should be implemented. That makes sense. Like, would you have anyone like do Kegels, like preemptively? Like, does that sound accurate? Like if they're pregnant or if they've had issues, they had issues 5 years ago or something. And I'm trying to understand, like, is there anything we can do to help reduce the risk of these conditions?
I think the biggest thing is awareness and recognizing when something's wrong. Just because sometimes if you're doing Kegels, like I'll have patients come in and say, I've been doing Kegels for 5 years. This isn't going to change anything. And then I do an internal exam and I'm like, because you've been doing Kegels to strengthen a really horrible restriction. So you've just made a muscle spasm that much worse because you have been over the past five years working on making this restriction solid as a rock. So that's why you're having issues. That's why you're having incontinence, because those muscles can't relax.
So it's the opposite problem. It's a mobility issue.
Right. Because there's no real way, unless you get an internal exam, of knowing, is this a restriction problem or is this a weakness problem?
Yeah, overactivating a muscle that's already overactive.
Right.
For women, hovering when they pee, does that actually mess with your pelvic floor?
Yeah. Right. Because you can't fully relax when you're still engaging those muscles. So when you're hovering and you're kind of keeping your butt where it's supposed to be and you're trying not to pee on the floor, on yourself or whatever, then those muscles are still sometimes engaged. So then it might not, because voiding and urinating is relaxing so that you're opening the urethral sphincter to allow for urine to pass through. So if you're still engaging some of those muscles that share common tendinous attachments, sometimes it's not going to relax. So then you might stand up after hover peeing and feel like, oh crap, I still have to go. Or then you start to retain.
If someone is concerned that they have a pelvic floor dysfunction, what should they do? Like, what should be the first? Someone's listening, like, damn, that's me. Like, right. You know, they're describing what I'm going through.
So
what should they do?
Certain insurances will cover what we call direct access, which means they can see a physical therapist for up to 30 days without having seen a physician. But unfortunately, not all insurances will accept that. So either reaching out to your primary care, sometimes they're pretty good with just, if you say, I want a prescription for physical therapy, sometimes they'll just write it for you. Your GYN...
Gotcha. All right. So you have a few options. You can go to your primary care. Mm-hmm. You can go directly to a physical therapist or your OBG would also be an option. Is there any other specialist that you feel like would be a good person for them to go to? And we talked about who can identify, but like what's another option, I guess?
Urologists, urogynecologists, but those are more specialists. So they would know about your issues.
Gotcha. Right. Yeah, I think it would make the most sense. Contact a PCP. We have a lot of patients who either don't have a PCP or don't communicate to their with their PCP regularly, and we almost become like their first point of contact. So if you have a PT, the physical therapist that you're comfortable with, I think it'd be important to reach out to them and say, hey, this is an issue I think I'm having. Do you know somebody who can help me with this, right?
Right, because some of it's just like a patient advocating for themselves because they don't know to advocate. Because they think it's normal or they've said it before and been brushed off. Because like I had a patient who I've seen now for I think like 3 or 4 different things who through conversation was literally said like, oh, don't make me laugh that hard. I'm going to pee myself. And I was like, what? Like,
let's talk about
who
that.
Who are we? Yeah. Like, listen, who you're talking to. Like, good thing we're here. And then she said, oh, I didn't realize that this was something that I could be fixed. I've never realized that it was something that I should bring up to my doctor. And again, like I mentioned before, some people are like embarrassed about it. Like, and it affects your social atmosphere as well. Cause some people, if they wear pads, if they leak too much, suddenly they're going to be like, oh my God, I can't be around friends. I smell like urine. And then they don't want to go out into public. And it kind of becomes like a vicious cycle where mental health is brought into it as well. But sure. Not bringing it up, I think, is something that unfortunately happens often. So just advocating and saying like, this is not normal. So what do I do?
In the circumstance in which you're seeing a patient who's dealt with a sexual trauma of some kind, like we said earlier, to diagnose or to do an assessment, there has to be an internal examination. How do you go about doing that or explaining that or educating? What are the steps that you take with that individual?
I mean, for me personally, what I typically like before I even do a pelvic exam or before I like start to talk about it, I screen right off the bat. Have you experienced any sort of sexual trauma or trauma to your pelvic region? Cause trauma isn't always necessarily sexual. It could be that you were in a car accident or had a really bad fall off of a horse or something like that. But I try to address it right off the bat. And then if they say, yes, I have, then I say, okay, like let's kind of detour here and talk about that. Have you spoken with somebody to kind of figure out where your headspace is on that? Would you be comfortable with undergoing a pelvic exam? It's not going to be, I try to tell them exactly what I'm going to be doing. Like I'm going to take a gloved finger. I will be doing this, that, and the other thing. And if at any point you are uncomfortable with the examination, consent's an ongoing thing. It's not a one-time yes or no. It's something that throughout the entire treatment, if you want to stop, no questions asked, we're done. If you want to resume at any point, again, no questions asked, we'll resume. You're in control. This is not something I'm pushing on you. So if somebody has had some sort of a trauma, I try to make them as comfortable as I can. And then if there's another provider, if they have a psychologist or psychiatrist involved, then I try to loop them in and say like, hey, just giving you a heads up. This is something that I'm treating them for. It might resurface in their talks with you. And if they're not comfortable, then I just do external. But then I have to kind of give them the caveat of the only way I'm truly going to know how your pelvic floor is activating or not activating is internally, but I can certainly do my best externally.
Wait, what do you think, Lara? That's a great answer.
Yeah. Everything Emily touched on, I agree with. Yeah, you can do an external evaluation of those muscles. It's a little harder because you're going through the glutes and you can't quite feel as well as you can internally. But if somebody's not comfortable with an internal exam, then we're not going there.
Right. Like you're in the driver's seat. This is not the car I'm driving. You are driving it.
Yeah. I think
you're
you
in control.
Two things that like really, you know, kind of caught my attention. Consent is an ongoing thing. That's so important. And I feel like we probably do it instinctively. We repeat that throughout our like mobilizations or whatever we're doing. Like, listen, this is like, if you're uncomfortable, let me know. Just tell me. Like, I'll probably say that five times if I'm doing like a hip mobilization with a strap, you know, tied around myself and the patient's leg, much less what you guys are doing. And the other thing that caught my attention is communication with the physician. If you feel like they were hesitant, or there was some, you know, resistance to certain things that you wanted to do in the examination, that's great. I'm all about communicating with the referral source on what's going on, because you want all parties to be on the same page.
Right. And sometimes somebody will say, oh yeah, I had something happen a couple of years ago, but you know, I'm fine now. And then I find out that they're still speaking with a psychologist. And then I say like, hey, just letting you know, I'm doing an internal exam on somebody who's a sexual trauma survivor. And then they say, oh my goodness, yes, she's been having this go on for years. And I'm like, oh my God, that's not what they let on to me. So then I can become privy to that information throughout, you know, all the HIPAA standards and whatnot. But then I can recognize that, and it helps me treat them better with a different, not that I wouldn't be empathetic otherwise, but that way I understand that this is something that's still going on, or this could be why this has become a chronic problem or what have you.
I know Lara's dealt with this, like the information you can get from a physician about a patient going into that. And it, you're right, that probably doesn't change a ton for me, at least. It may even change like how quickly I get into treatment, right? Like maybe I talk to them for 5-10 minutes before we even like start like a stretch or a mobilization, whatever. You know what I mean? That's interesting stuff. All right, so let's get into the five quick cues. One, what is the most challenging aspect of treating pelvic floor conditions, Lara?
They're usually pretty complicated. A lot of history, a lot of psychosocial issues. So just kind of weeding out what their goals are, what's important, and how to get them better as quick as possible.
Same or different answer?
I mean, similar. I think a lot of it is the tying in the psychosocial, where we all joke as PTs is sometimes we're more therapists than physical therapists, but it truly does become something where like I never imagined I'd be having to take multiple trauma courses to understand how to best deal with trauma. So tying that into it.
Yeah, no, that great answers. One way to increase awareness of pelvic floor conditions. Go ahead, Emily.
I mean, just talking about it. Like I always joke with some of my female patients, I'll say like, when you get wine with your girls on Friday night, I know you guys are going to be laughing. If anyone says, oh my God, and starts crossing their legs, be like, no, it's not normal. Talk to your pelvic floor therapist or talk to your PCP and like get that figured out, because it's not normal. So just like talking about it.
Good.
Is a big thing.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
Yeah. Education. Just getting the word out there, however you can, to your friends, family.
I know Emily does this a lot. Maybe you do it too, Lara. I don't know. But I know, Emily, you post on LinkedIn all the time about like pelvic floor stuff.
Yeah. And I have a pelvic floor Instagram that I'll talk about. Like, hey, not normal. Like, did you think this was normal? A lot of people think it is. It's not. This is what you can do to address it. That sort of thing. Because like, and it's also something that like, I kind of like, this is like my sexy money line with it, with like, it'll make your sex life better. Like it's a win-win. Like you won't leak and you'll have a better sex life. Like who's going to complain about that?
All right. So what's one exercise everyone can do right now to improve their strength of their pelvic floor?
Any glute work. So band walks are a great one. The stronger your butt is, the stronger your pelvic floor is going to be.
And so that's a band around the ankles.
Band around the ankles, walking sideways.
Okay.
I like planks. Ooh, and any kind of plank variation. Because if you can hold a plank, that's fantastic. But like Lara was touching on with like the force pressure system that our core is, if you're holding tight with everything but your pelvic floor, you're not going to be really holding an effective plank. So if you can hold an effective plank with a pelvic floor contraction, I think that's like awesome.
I like that. What do you enjoy the most about treating pelvic floor pathologies?
Getting people back to workouts, whatever it is. I mean, I'm talking, I guess, specifically postpartum moms, just getting them back to what they could before they were pregnant.
Yeah, go ahead, Anne.
I just like how like a lot of pelvic floor muscle spasms can have referral patterns that present like orthopedic dysfunction. So like a sciatica can sometimes be an obturator internus spasm. Or like a prolapse can sometimes present like chronic low back pain. It gets worse when you stand up. It goes away when you sit. It's worse by the end of the day. Some people would think, oh, it's like a degenerative disc or like a spondylolisthesis. It's not necessarily, it could be pelvic in nature. So trying to weed out those sorts of things, and then finding that like people are like, oh my God, I thought this was like a forever thing, and it's not.
Yeah, I would imagine those are two great answers. So finding like the doozies that no one else could figure out, and it actually being pelvic floor, a pelvic floor condition, and then like getting the, you know, the athlete, so to speak, or the individual who was very active, went through childbirth, you know, pregnancy, childbirth, and like has like an identity crisis almost.
Yeah, that's so common.
I'm sure. And going from that to, I'm like, I feel like I'm me again, you know, and I just have this little one with me too, but like I'm back to doing what I love to do for me. So,
yeah, because that postpartum depression sometimes has like a dissociation from self. Where like, okay, I was a you know, I was a wife and now I'm a mom and I can't do anything.
Yeah, I mean, like complete role change, right?
Right.
So, no, I think that's really important to point out. One fact about pelvic floor that will shock the average person. Go ahead, Emily.
Ooh. I think the first one that comes to mind is everyone thinks about, not to go back to the sex topic, but erectile dysfunction is sometimes a pelvic floor dysfunction where a muscle is too weak to cut off blood supply and hold it off, or it's in spasm and blood can't enter. So instead of having to take a pharmaceutical like a Viagra that has all sorts of risks like stroke and hemorrhaging and all sorts of fun stuff with your blood flow, you can just get some pelvic floor therapy and then you don't have to take a pill.
You might open up a can of worms there. Yeah. We got to be careful with your contact information that we give out. That's a great... Yeah,
that's like my fun fact.
No, Isabel and I both looked at each other, we like raised our eyebrows like, oh, really? Okay. go ahead, Lara. What's one that would shock the average person?
I guess one thing that I get from a lot of people is that men also have a pelvic floor, which a lot of people, women and men, don't know about. So we treat women and we also treat men.
That's a great answer.
Yeah, good segue.
No, great answers. Anything else to add? Do you guys want to dive into anything else? You guys want to talk about other things that I haven't asked about or we haven't discussed?
All right. I think we kind of hit everything.
Cool. No, I think this is great. Like I was telling a couple of the PTs earlier today, I was doing a podcast tonight and you guys were going to be here. Like, I don't know much about pelvic floor. Like Lara thinks I might, but I really don't.
You know more than you
think. But it's, these are my favorite podcasts because I'm not educated on it, you know, nearly as well as you guys are. So I'm learning as I'm asking questions and I don't want to sound stupid asking the questions, but I also don't care that much. So, so this has been amazing. Thank you guys both so much for coming on. We want to make sure our audience is able to reach out to you, via, you know, social media or email, call, whatever. So Emily, what contact information would you like to share with our listeners so they can reach out?
So my email address is my name. It's Emily, Emily.Titus, T-I-T-U-S, at ivrehab.com. So I-V as in Victor, Y-rehab.com. And then I do have my pelvic floor Instagram. So my Instagram handle is orthopfptpa. It's quite a mouthful.
And those will be in the show notes. So you're good there. And then your LinkedIn?
Yes, my LinkedIn is just, my name, Emily Titus, PTDPT on LinkedIn.
Cool. And go for it, Lara.
My email is also my name, Lara, L-A-R-A dot Kuisumbing, Q-U-I-S-U-M-B-I-N-G at ivrehab.com. And I am lame and don't have any social media. So that's it. You can smart. Email me.
All right. No, perfect. Thank you guys so much for getting on the podcast and educating myself and our audience.
Thank you.
So, all right. Appreciate you guys. That's a wrap.
Thanks for listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast. If you'd like this episode, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It would mean so much to me if you could leave us a 5-star review so more listeners like you could get this important information. See you next time.